Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so another JREP session for you today. And this time we discuss, or more accurately, pick Emil's encyclopedia-like brain about Japanese mortgage interest rates, why you should shop around for mortgages before signing anything, how much you can potentially borrow, what happens if you get a home loan and then move out of Japan, and also when and how to register your new address when purchasing. So interesting little loophole there. We then segue from that chat about Japanese bureaucratic procedures to another similar conversation about registering a car in Japan for non-residents who purchase properties here. And as a side note, while this episode was recorded a while back and I mention in it that we're looking into the possibility, I can now happily testify that we've actually done it on behalf of a non-resident or two. So it is definitely possible to register a car in Japan as long as you own a property, even if you're not a resident, although it's definitely not a simple procedure. So don't be shy to reach out if this is you. We also talk a bit about hankos or inkans, Japanese identification stamps or seals, how they work or don't work here. So really interesting, nuanced conversation with plenty of examples there about Japanese strictness, which interestingly enough goes hand in hand with an equal amount of vagueness on official procedures, foreigner loopholes, and so forth. And finally, a bit more of a casual chat about Emil's upcoming Tokyo Dads podcast, all about fatherhood and families in Japan, and even about Japan's minister in charge of gender equality and his embarrassing appearance at a recent G7 international summit on the topic. So really fun, information-packed conversation for you there. Enjoy the banter, and I'll see you again on the other side.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks, everyone. Welcome to the JREP, Japan Real Estate Expert Panel podcast. I'm doing an introduction. My name's Emil. I'm a real estate agent here in Tokyo, helping people buy their personal homes in Japan. Blanca, over to you.
Hello, I'm Blanca Kobayashi. I'm from ARC Reform, Tokyo. We have offices in Tokyo and in Matsudo, and we take care of renovating your beautiful properties in that you have basically in Kanto area. So we can go pretty far if you have that nice project and you want to work with us. We are bilingual, so you don't have to worry that you will have to stress with your Japanese too much dealing with all the contractors. We'll do that on your behalf. And Ziv?
I'm Ziv Nakajima again, co-founder and partner at NTI. And for the last 12 years, we've been helping foreigners, resident or non-resident, purchase and manage and sell whatever they want anywhere in Japan. Family homes, we leave to the good people at Emil's company. If it's in Tokyo, but anything else, we're happy to. But we are not doing any sales. I've been prohibited from bringing on new customers until the end of August, which is probably going to be before this is published anyway. But apologies if you have called us and we said that we have to take a hiatus. We just end of financial year and we lost our bookkeeper. Two other staffs are in the office due to COVID, and it's just a bloody nightmare.
Speaking of purchasing properties, Japan interest rates. I've recently been doing some deals with clients, some home loans. So a lot of my work is getting the home loans sorted out for my long-term Japanese residence. And the rates are down a little bit. The variable rates are down 0.39, 0.59% instead of 0.65, what they were a few months ago.
It went up a little bit about a year ago. Was that to the same extent?
No, so that was more like the 10-year and longer 35-year fixed rates have gone up, but the variables, they're going down because the short-term variable, like the variable rate hasn't really changed at all. And
that's dirt cheap.
It's free money. It's nothing. It's like, you know, and even then, when you say they went down 0.1% compared to what they were, you know, a year, two, 3 years ago, but they're still, you know, ridiculously low. It's almost nothing. I've mentioned other times on this podcast, at that kind of rate, over a 35-year loan, you're paying about 15% total back to the bank as interest costs. So if you borrow 100 million yen, you're paying 115 million back to the bank. They're only making 15 million yen over the life of the loan, which is absolute peanuts.
Of course.
When you're used to, like, you know, interest rates, what we see in Australia and the West right now, it's about 7%.
Yeah.
When it was around 4%, I think that's when it gets to double. If you borrow $1 million from the bank, you have to repay 2 million. You basically pay double one, like, you know, in interest.
Yeah.
Now at 7%, it's even more. It's about, you know, what, 1.2 to 1.4% times extra to the bank.
Yeah. Europe is crazy as well. Europe is like 6 to 9 or something like that.
Yeah, it's going up quite a bit. One of the loans we just got for a client who bought a brand new mansion, I was just doing the numbers now. We got the approval call on Monday, including closing costs. The first bank approved just the property price, which was 155 million. Then we got another bank that we applied to include closing costs. And that's, they're including another, what's it come to, about 6 million yen in closing costs. So they're approving just a little bit over 6 million yen. So the property is 155 and the loan is being approved for 162 million.
Mm-hmm.
So all the closing costs, the agency fee, the taxes, the insurance, the registration fee, all of that stuff is being included. So he's basically coming out like nothing out of pocket for 155 million yen property. And the mortgage repayment on 162 million yen on what he's getting over 35 years is 430,000 yen a month.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Mm.
Fully amazing. Paid. Yeah. It's a,
so how much, I'm sorry to ask this now, but for this 400,000 loan, how much he had to show in income?
Oh, this one, his income is a bit more complex. He's a higher income earner. Mm-hmm. Generally, and I think you'd actually borrow more, but generally you need you can borrow about 7 to 8 times your annual income. So if I divided by 8. So if you earn about 20 to 25 million yen a year.
A year? If you earn 25 million a year, which is nothing.
No, 25. You said like
25, not, oh, yes,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
25,
yeah,
so, that's 2 million a year. That's 2 million a month still.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, so usually the simple rule is you can borrow about 7 to 8 times your annual income. So if you earn, 7 million yen a year, so 700,000.
Yeah. So you can get 49 million.
About 50 million yen you can borrow. So
which is about 65,000 US a year for our non-Japanese resident listeners.
Yeah. Just based on current, current exchange rates, I think, which are historically low or historically high for the US dollar. Mm. In general, you can borrow about 7 to 8 times your gross annual income if you're a salaried employee. Once you start earning around the 20 million yen and more a year, the banks are a bit more favorable towards you.
Yeah.
And they do want to do, they do want to do the deal. They like those high net income earners.
Of course.
And, but also what you find is when people are sort of in that price range, they don't always just borrow their maximum amount. They have, you know, when you're, you know, a higher net worth individual, you also have other sources of income, other investments, other cash assets. Your income is not paid as a basic salary. Often you're also getting bonuses.
Yeah.
You're not just a standard operational, you know, salaried employee, etc. So it's not, it works a little bit different when you get into those ranges. But for the most part, for anyone who's just a typical salaried employee, 7 to 8 times your gross annual income is an easy way to
figure it out. Did you have to deal, or did you came across a situation that, okay, you sold a property and got a mortgage for a client that was, again, you know, high income earner here in Japan. He bought a property, lived in the property for a few years, and then was relocated.
Yes.
And stopped earning in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Did you encounter that? And how did the bankers? I had it with one client, and we were talking about renovation for this client, and he ended up selling the property because the bank was basically pressuring him to pay up or sell the property because he was no longer employed in Japan and didn't have any income in Japan.
So it's not about having income in Japan. Once you buy the property, someone, that's a very good and relevant question. Usually, once you get the loan, it's don't notify the bank. You don't, like, there's no need to notify the bank of changes. Not there's no need. Like, if you start notifying, say, hey, I'm leaving the country. I'm moving out. I'm no longer going to live in this address. Even if you're not leaving the country, let's say you're moving to Osaka, you're moving out to Matsudo further away, wherever it may be. If it's no longer your primary residence, then the bank gave you a home loan. They want you to keep it as a home loan, as your primary residence.
Mm.
That's the issue. So
I think that's where he made the mistake.
Yeah. But if you don't notify them, then they don't know any different. And also, if you, and then there are circumstances, let's say your company transfers you, and this is the same for Japanese nationals, not just foreigners. Let's say your company wants to transfer you overseas for 3 years.
Yeah.
And then come back. Then, you know, if you do want to notify the bank, then you can sort of discuss with the bank, this is my situation. I am going to come back, but I'm gone for a few years. So it depends on how you, you know, one, whether you mention it to the bank or not, and two, how you mention it if you decide to, right? But if it's, oh, I'm just going to turn it into an investment property and leave, you're like, well, hold on, no, we gave you a home loan. So it's more on a case-by-case basis and how much you wish to disclose to the bank.
I just had the same conversation with someone, one of our customers yesterday. He's an airline pilot and he's living in Japan and working for ANA. And now he's potentially relocating to another company. So he'll be moving out of and flying out of Japan. And he's got an apartment that he bought with a mortgage, just wondering how that would work if he wants to rent it out when it's not, when he's not here.
Yeah. So,
that could always be treated as a temporary relocation. But the question is, at the bottom line, it's the bank that decides, doesn't it? So it's up to case officer kind of discretion.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. If you call the bank and say, hey, bank, I'm leaving the country and your policy says I shouldn't do it. So what, like, you know, so what should I do? They say, oh, well, thank you for notifying us. Now we have a whole bunch of administrative stuff to do. You know, if you had to shut up, we would have not known about this, but now you brought it to our attention. Thank you. Let's, you know, all sort of grind our teeth and suffer through this.
Banks in Japan are a bit strange, aren't they?
Well, you do know that a lot of times in
Japanese,
Japan,
I find.
No. But here's the thing: there are often, yeah, and you see this at the ward office all the time. There's the process and the policy. The formal one that's written and documented. And then in practice, there's always there's often like a tacit understanding that, well.
Oh, even in the immigration department, actually, yeah.
Yeah. There's a tacit thing, oh, this is, it's not written, we wouldn't document it, but commonly this is how it flows. Like a great example of this is when you want to register a property, when you buy a property and you want to register the title, they ask, the banks asks us, the scrivener asks us always, is do you want to use your current address or the new address of the property you're going to buy, you're going to move into? And we say, well, so what happens when you register the title? If, let's say I live in Setagaya now, I buy a new house in Shibuya. When I buy it, let's say the settlement is on August 31st, I have to present my residency certificate and Inkan certificate, Inkan Shomeisho, to the scrivener, and they go and prepare the title change. And they'll prepare that in advance. So on settlement day, they can go register the title and says, Emil Gorgis of this address owns this new property in Shibuya. However, my current address is Setagaya. So when I get my residency certificate issued, it's from Setagaya Ward. So if they register it and it's my new house is going to be in Shibuya, on the title, it says, this house in Shibuya is owned by Emil of Setagaya. But then I move one day after that. And like, well, then I have to, you know, a lot of people don't, but technically you need to update the title to show your new address. So what they say is go to Shibuya.
No, you don't have to. You can do that upon sale.
Yeah. I mean, it's not really necessary at all, but it's an extra process. What you can do though is you go to the ward, Shibuya ward office, and say, I moved last week to this house that hasn't actually been finished building yet. I don't own it yet.
Yeah.
And it's not really mine yet, but I actually moved last week. So give me the new Jumihyo residency certificate and Hanko certificate for the new address. And so when they register it, they register you, you're on the title, it shows you of your new address.
Yeah.
You haven't actually moved. And if you look at any of the wards, they say you cannot initiate this unless you've already moved, right? You can't say you've moved before you've actually moved. Right.
But most of, like, a lot of my clients, if they buy a used property, they move the address before we actually finish the renovations and they move.
Precisely. That is, well, in this case, you're moving the address before you even buy it.
You see.
Right. Before it's even purchased. But so formally, according to the ward office documentation, you're not meant to do that.
But before buying, that's risky.
But no one, oh no, not retail, like no one actually, like they, that's a tacit approval. It's a process that everyone knows. Even the bank asks us, the scrivener asks us, they say, you can do this. Just say a date before the actual settlement that you moved in order to issue the certificate. Technically, okay, you're not meant to do that. But even though, you know, it's one of those that they turn a blind eye to it. It's tacitly approved. Don't mention that to the people at City Hall. Blatantly tell them, I haven't bought it yet. They'll say, when are you actually moving? Oh, next week, but I need the paperwork now. Just zip it. Don't mention it. And get the, you know, get it from the previous date, and it's completely fine. So, and that's the process. And all the banks and the scriveners will ask us that process. So I think in Japan, there's quite often these tacit, just don't mention it and no one says anything. We'll, you know, we're not going to write you, give you a formal letter that says it's okay.
Yeah.
But it's agreed. And
nobody specifically will give you anything in written form.
Yeah. So
we did research for a customer a while ago who is not a resident but wants to buy and drive a car in Japan.
That was an issue they were talking about some time ago, with the parking.
Who was talking about it?
I encountered this issue. It was discussed on one of the foreign groups on Facebook.
Yeah.
Because basically it's kind of like a loop. You have to have a car. No, you have to have a registered parking to be able to purchase a car and register the car in your name. Right, in Japan.
Yes, but that's the person who owns the property, so the parking wasn't an issue. So when you start looking around, like all of these articles in English keep telling you that it's impossible to do if you don't have, because you need your junicio and your incanchoma and all of the things that you can't get unless you're a resident. In reality, so we kept searching Japanese websites just to confirm that, and there's nothing anywhere that says that.
Nope.
So we pick up the phone, we call the transport office, and they're like, oh yeah, it's possible. You can do that with an Old Republic certificate. You can do that with this, you can do that with it. But it's not gonna be written anywhere. Like it's well known. And they said, well, if you want 100% confirm, you can call that local ward office and ask them. Did the same thing, got the same answer, but it's not written anywhere.
Did the person end up registering or buying the car and registering it with his house?
He hasn't done it yet, but according to what they've told us on the phone, and again they wouldn't provide it in writing, same story exactly, is whatever qualifies as an alternative to a Jumihio and Inkanchome, which overseas is an notary public statutory declaration and a certificate of signature.
Mm-hmm.
If it's translated with a certified translation, that's completely acceptable here.
You see. Yeah.
So, yeah.
But it's not written anywhere. And so everyone who's writing articles and forum posts and Reddit posts about it in English is saying, no, can't be done.
I've had an American expat friend of mine, company sort of director level, and he wanted to buy a car and register it, and they said, you know, oh well, you need a hanko. And he's like, well, I don't want to register my hanko. I'm only here for a few years. I don't want to do the hanko thing. And we know it's no big deal, but you know, he was new here and didn't want to sort of complicate things. His mind goes, so what's the process around it? And they said, well, you can just get it notarized, go to the American embassy and get your documentation notarized, and you can do that. So he felt more comfortable doing that approach. So yeah, I've always known that that's been an option, and it's kind of the two times you that in my experience that you need a registered hanko certificate is when you transfer a title for either a house or a car. And actually the third time I needed it was when I was registering some properties for Airbnb, getting them licensed. I needed some certification for that, but in general most people will only need it to transfer a title of ownership, and that is a car title or a property title.
Or to a bank account.
You don't need the registration.
You don't need it for a bank account. I had a bank account for years without actually having a hanko, because I refused to have it. Because I was like, oh mendoksai, I just didn't want it to deal with the whole thing. And I was like, I knew I was leaving the next year. Yeah. Or so I thought. So I didn't have registered hanko, but I did have a bank account. I had even Citibank at the time didn't need a bank account. We had signature, and SMBC used to be the same. I don't know how now, but I had a bank account in SMBC and in Mitsui Sumitomo without having hanko.
There's a few things people confuse. One is, and yet since always, if you're a foreigner, you can get away with signing at the bank where it says hanko, you can sign back from 20 years ago and even now. For Japanese, they want a hanko, but very different is a registered certificate, your registered hanko. So you can go to Don Quixote or an Inkan shop, and they got the machines there, and register, like get one made up, you know, that says Gorgis or you know, Nakajima, Magen, whatever you like. And you can use that for stamping lots of documents, but whether you actually go to the ward office and register that hanko, that and get the certificate for that registration, that certificate from the ward office only needs to be done for is required very rarely for title transfers.
Don't you need inkanchoma even when you are registering a company?
Actually, yes, I believe so. Yes, that kind of stuff. So title registration, when you're incorporating or making a title, that's when you need it for identity proof. But, you know, opening a bank account, you don't need it.
Yeah.
And so having that stamp is different. And I know lots of actual parents, lots of mums in particular, they get hankos with their name, and it's got like a little smiley face or an asterisk or whatnot on it, a star. So when they stamp like any of the school documents, It's like, I've signed it, but it's not an official hanko. Yeah. Can't be used fraudulently.
Yeah. Schools, they usually even tell you, we do not want your official hanko.
Yeah.
They literally, like, they want the Hakuyan shop, you know, small thing. They don't even want to see your actual hanko because, I, you know, don't know, can be copied or you know, misused. So they don't even
Saying that a hanko is not a secure way to do transactions, Blanc?
Oh, darling, it's 100% secure. It's, it cannot go any other way.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
And now they've actually got at the banks, it's called. So they're trying to do away with the, you know, the new digital ministry is working hardly to remove these extra requirements. And but one of them now, some banks are doing Inkan lists. Without Inkan, Inkanless kōza.
Some government offices too.
Yeah, no Inkan bank accounts. Inkanless kōza is what they call it. Yeah. So some of, like SMBC does that now. So you don't actually, there's no Inkan registered at all.
Yeah.
No signature, no Inkan.
Banking in Japan is, I think that's a subject for a whole different podcast, because
but it is interesting. Why is it, like, if I compare it, for example, to other places where I've lived, so let's take Australia for example, there's a very clear procedure and checklist for every, and you either can or cannot do it, and that's it. There's no case officer discretion whatsoever. There's nothing that's going to be told you, or almost nothing that's going to be told to you over the phone or over the counter that's not written and read to you off an official document. But here, things seem to be left vague on purpose on many occasions. I wonder where that mentality comes from the Japanese, who are generally so chanto, proper about everything.
Well, Japanese, in my experience, like, they often don't say what you can or cannot do. Like, it's not what you cannot do. It's at each period, this is what is allowed. They don't say what's really disallowed, just what's allowed. A good example is when you do zoning, you know, in real estate analogies, when you do the zoning, property zoning, for a restricted residential area, you can have only residences. Mm-hmm. For a unrestricted residential area, you can have these kinds of, you can have residential, you can have hotels and motels, and that's it. And then for commercial areas, you can have residential and hotels and commercial, like shops and convenience stores, right? And then for industrial districts, it sort of, it adds to the level of unrestrictiveness,
Yeah.
So it's for each section, so these are also what's permitted. So they don't have a list of what's not permitted. These are what are permitted. So like this is, yeah, they remove the restrictions. Mm. So it doesn't really go into detail. And so sometimes like, can I have a this specific kind of business in this area? As like,
it doesn't say you can't.
Yeah, it doesn't say you can't. Yeah, it doesn't say you cannot do it.
Yeah.
Right.
So no, what's the reasoning behind it? Is it on purpose to make these
that's kind of their approach. Maybe they don't have to be overly policed.
Yeah, at some point, I think, but that's also why they are able to misuse a lot of things, is the little loopholes. And I don't think they realized how good foreigners are in actually finding the loopholes. If you think about I think the best example of the loophole, it's not related to real estate, but to foreigners run businesses, is the Mario Karts in Tokyo. When they found out that you can actually, you have to have a driver's license, but because it's a kart, you don't need a helmet, you don't need anything. You can be driving on the streets of Tokyo and you don't even have a helmet, you don't have anything. And why? When you have to do all these things when you are even on a motorbike, because that is a loophole in the law. And now, you know, for 5 years, they are talking about changing it, but you know, Japan and changing anything is not going to happen for another years. So those are the little loopholes that are there. And a lot of foreigners are just good in finding them. Same thing when you have like the renovation law, that basically as long as in some areas, it is as long as you leave one beam of the old house, it's not a rebuild, it's a renovation.
I was going to point that out. That's another example.
That one's crazy.
And then the next year, the renovation is that beam, right?
Yeah, you know.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, but it's the small things that I don't think that they ever assume people will be that creative.
Well, you know what? I kind of give them a little bit more credit. Like, there's two points to that.
Yeah,
that
I've got a feeling there's something more intentional there, too.
They like to make rules for the sake of, there was an issue, we've created a rule to resolve it, and then it's hands off. Similar to the anti-discrimination, Japan says, we don't need to make human rights and anti-discrimination rules, because there is a mechanism for if people feel discriminated, they can go through the courts and file a dispute. So there is a mechanism available. It's not a very practical mechanism. But if you feel that you've been, you know, racially discriminated, you can, there is a court process available to you, right? But so they don't blatantly make rules that you cannot, you know, that you can't discriminate based on race. Another one example I find, and then to the point, sorry, Blanca, of foreigners find the loophole, I think it's because we come across it because we're foreign. My favorite example, actually, in terms of loophole that is really only for foreigners is, you know, in general, when, and they just did this in the Supreme Court as well recently, a woman is not able to keep her maiden name when she gets married. She must enter the family register of her husband, right? And so, like,
not anymore.
90%. Oh, no, 90% of the time, the woman goes into the husband's family register called Teki Tohon, and thus acquires his family name, because the family register cannot have two different family names. 10% of cases, roughly, or I think it's a bit less, the man actually goes into the woman's family register and acquires her family name. But more commonly, because it's the woman that does it, the woman has to give up her family name. And there was recently, went to the Supreme Court. Hold on, but here's the loophole though, Lenka. If you are marrying a foreigner,
yes, that's what I want.
Then if you're marrying a foreigner, which again Japanese don't come across that, because both husband and wife will have a family register. Mm-hmm. But if in my case, you know, the husband, I am a foreigner, I don't have a family register. So my wife is the only one with the family register. She can choose to keep her family name.
Yeah,
if she wants, it's completely optional.
Yeah.
Right. In my case, my wife did change her name to Gorgis as well. So her family register has her name in katakana, not Ramaji. It's her name in katakana. And I was actually fine with her keeping her maiden name. Like, it didn't bother me, but I wanted the kids to be Gorgis. And in order for that to happen, because they are on her family register, they would keep the same name. And we didn't want to and then the way Australia works, Australian passports will keep the same name as their Japanese ones. So in order for them to be Gorgis, the family register had to be Gorgis. Or we remove them from the family register and go to the family court and have them get their own family each child has their own family register at birth with the Gorgis surname, which differs from the mum's surname. It's complexity. But anyway, these are things that we come across. I don't want to say it's a loop. It's a loophole that Japanese just don't encounter.
Yeah, at the time, I think there were a lot of things that they were not thinking about at the time when they were making those laws and restrictions. And also, if you think about it, most of them are so old that the life changed completely. And like David says always, Mama, jidai chigau, you know, like the times are very different. And nowadays, you know, when you do something, you realize you can do it because there is no law against it. Because when they were making those particular laws, these things were not happening.
Yeah.
So like
foreigners, we don't have them in Japan. What's it matter?
Yeah.
Or no one's going to marry them anyway. Or similar. Family, a divorce. Why would the dad want to see the kids?
Yeah,
the divorce
don't
is separated.
Even what's go there. To do with no,
but let's not even go. Yeah, please.
That is a very sore subject in Japan.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I think that. Yeah. Oh my God.
Let's get down that route.
Oh, I mean, sorry, Emil. Speaking of parenthood, why don't you give us a little bit of brief about your new podcast?
Oh yes, work in progress.
Oh, you have a new podcast.
Yes, I have recorded two so far, but wow, it is difficult to edit. I'm still getting, so the Tokyo Dads podcast is starting. We're starting a Facebook group as well, the Tokyo Dads, Facebook group, just search Tokyo Dads. And basically it's a podcast. I'm going to do one-on-one interviews with other dads in Tokyo, foreign dads in Tokyo. But even I've got lots of Japanese friends, Japanese guys that are dads, but also they're very Western. So maybe they were a bit raised overseas or they went to school overseas. And they are also really interesting to talk to because they are kind of, they've gotten the experience that our kids are going to go through.
Yes.
Right? Being raised sort of bilingual or living, you know, going to overseas school and coming back and having that mixed culture clash. And also because they're Japanese and they have kids in Japanese school already, they also really are familiar with the Japanese education system from their personal experience and through their children that we're trying now as foreign parents trying to navigate for our own kids. So they're actually a wealth of information about their personal experience going through the juku, the cram school process and all that sort of stuff. So it's really, I found when I get together with my friends, which are, you know, I'm 41 years old, almost 42. When I get together with other dads, you know, be it young dads who have kids, you know, newborns or, you know, young families, or they're maybe a bit my senior, we're always talking about kid stuff, raising bilingual children, dealing with, you know, marriage or relationships in Japan. Most times there's a foreign wife, Japanese wife with a foreign husband. My clients are also often this kind of family makeup. So that's the kind of discussion that we have. And we finish having a beer and a chat. And I'm like, this discussion we just had is so useful for so many people.
Yeah.
So, so I bought all the podcasts set up. I bought a whole bunch of different whiskeys. So that's the plan. And I've done two recordings so far and they're about an hour each. I'm going through and doing the editing, but I want to have a nice intro. And, you know, I've got one guy who was in a band, one of my friends, who's preparing an intro jingle and whatnot. So there's a lot I want to, because people are giving me a solid hour of their time to discuss, I want to make sure I present it correctly. I have the good quality audio, the good sort of production.
Nice.
So, and often I'm trying to do it face to face, even if I've got to sort of travel around.
You're not contrasting Japan. That with the quality of this podcast, are you, Emil? Yeah. the technical quality well, we know that the content is of equal value, but the technical quality I do agree, but I mean
the vibe is different
without a lot of content, so I'm not even gonna worry about that.
Yeah, but also like one-on-one is different.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, look, this is, you know, here we're just sort of chatting and bantering about, you know, the industry. But if, you know, I want to have a quality one-hour personal engagement time with someone to really give me a lot of detail about their personal life and how they view things, especially with parenting and being a dad and the struggles and their tactics and techniques, I feel like, you know, why not do it right? Give them, like, it's probably one of the few times they're going to spend a solid hour. And in the discussions I've had, we tend to go more deeper than just what we generally do in a conversation because, hey, we're recording for a podcast. We're trying to get information. So I do try to delve deep and I'm trying to get better at asking questions and being a good host and asking good questions. That's complex. So I want to do it right. And I want to sort of do justice to the person who's giving their time to do it, you know?
And it's, we should note that the name is Tokyo Dads, but it's, the content is definitely very viable to any foreign dad, or like you said, Japanese international dad living in Japan, but, doesn't have to be the group, the Facebook group as well. We can actually join. I've noticed if we're not from Tokyo, right?
Yeah, definitely. So it's called Tokyo Dads just because I wanted to make it, you know, on the Tokyo Dads podcast. I want to kind of keep it easy to understand. But that's it. The idea is foreign dads in Japan. And you don't have to be foreign. And you don't have to be a dad. If you're considering, you know, maybe you got a pregnant wife or you just got married and you're like, should we have kids? You want to talk to other dads. I find regardless of business, you know, when we meet people through our life and we see, oh, maybe they're, often we gauge stuff, social status and what we can learn or mentorship based on age and sort of career situation when it comes to men anyway, because generally we're the ones that work. Also, like, most men work, women, they'll work, but because they have kids, they can be on and off employment.
They just work twice
that situation. It's different, but yeah, there's lots of
in Japan.
Emil. Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. There's lots of mothers groups already. Yes, so I think for dads, you know, we have our own approach to things. But when it comes to career, we see people that are more senior than us in our career and experience. We consider them as mentors, right? Business mentors, and often we look at people junior to us. Well, we try to mentor them, okay, in terms of business. But when it comes to parenting, it's like, even if someone is my senior at a company, I've got three young kids. If they're just having a baby, then they're asking me questions about having a child.
And right? I also think, Emil, fatherhood or the role of fathers in families in Japan is heavily underestimated or like even kind of dismissed.
Like the same way that Japanese women are the vast untapped resource of the economy here, I think Japanese men are the vast untapped resource of families. Yes. There is so much they can give their kids.
I had a really hard time when David was in Yochien. And for the graduation event, they only organized it for the moms and did not invite any father.
Wow.
And I was, I went so angry. I told them I'm not
That's
going.
That's hardcore even for Japan, actually.
Yeah, because they said, oh, the fathers are not really interested. I said, did you ask them? You know, like, oh, it's like a sayonara and thank you between the mothers and the teachers. I told them it's bullshit. So I said, we are not participating as a family. Mm.
Yeah.
I'm not going. If my husband cannot go, I'm not going. And they were genuinely shocked. I was the only mother that did not attend it. And then the rest of them had a nice lunch with the teachers while their husband went and get obento on their own. Because it was the mothers and the children. And after the graduation, they sent the fathers away and they had a celebratory lunch with the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I was so upset. I was like, this is the biggest bullshit I've heard in my life. Yeah. I was the only one. I was the only one who had a problem. And they said, oh, but it's the way it always been. And that was their, like, you know, fathers, they just, and I said, because the fathers, they don't participate enough. I said, yeah, because they are at work to pay for your bills and for your fees. And they just completely disregard that. So I was just so upset.
Yeah, there's I think both systems are backwards in Japan, but also
very
a lot of, I think also a lot of mums and a lot of women are also like still in Japan completely on board with, yes, that's the role, that's what I do, and that they're happy with it. It's not, they're not the ones necessarily fighting
for
back.
Them it's more like they don't want to raise their voice to protest. It's the way it is. I literally got, particularly at this event, I got the answer like, well, that's how it's always been. So what can we cannot do anything to change it. I said, it's, this is where you hard, are wrong.
It's if you, hard to say. I mean, I've met so many different people with different opinions, even among Japanese. Some of them are definitely happy with the situation. Some of them are not. And, and it runs the gamut, male and
they
female.
They are not willing to have the conversation about it.
Yes.
Like, should we maybe change it? Or make it an optional, do you want your husband to come or not, right? Yeah. Even if it's just an option, I believe maybe, you know, even if it's a third of the fathers that would come and the rest would not come, but it's good for them to have the option to come, not to tell them, well, you are simply not invited, you cannot come.
When I went to, so I just came back from Australia, and my son, who's in Australia right now, he's on the soccer team at his school. So he's a fourth grader. When we had there was on the WhatsApp chat, it's okay, we're having the soccer club is having a dinner on a Friday night at one of the family restaurants with the kids play area and stuff. My wife said to me, oh, is it the dads or the mums? Like, who's organizing it? Because in Japan, when we have the soccer club, it's like the coach will have a night out drinking with the dads, and then another night out drinking with the mum's group and the dad's group. Like, it's separate. And I go, oh, well, I have no idea, but I'm going. My wife's like, ah, you know, that's fine, I'll just leave it, like, because a lot of the dads were going to go, like, they're like, yeah, me plus one plus two whatever, go there. Apart from my wife, pretty much every mum was there, and even one of the guys, his parents were also, like, the grandparents were also there, mum and dad. And it was like, hold on. And there was like the mum's table and the dad's table, but yeah, they basically all attended except for my wife, who was like, oh, okay, I didn't realize the mums are going to attend too, because she, you know, I guess we're accustomed to how it is here in Japan. But things are changing. Like, wasn't there just recently that woman that they were posting lots of memes about it, but I think just a few weeks ago, there was like a women's empowerment conference.
Oh, Jesus, that was hilarious.
That hilarious.
Maybe Blanca, you can explain that a little bit better.
Well, the Ministry for Equality, right? Hearing
they hosted it, didn't they? Yeah.
Everywhere else, I think in almost every other country, the Minister for Equality and whatever is a female, it's a woman. In Japan, of course, it's a man. So then they did a conference that was equality and female empowerment.
Yeah.
And there was 10, 12 female leaders. And then there was the Japanese prime minister, a man, the only one.
The Japanese minister
for equality or whatever he is. And on top of that, and this was hilarious, they made Japan to be the chair for the event.
Mm.
So a Japanese male minister was the chair for a
event. The women empowerment.
For women empowerment. That was just the most hilarious. This exactly showed how this country works.
It was a row of well-presented women with a very sore thumb male. One with single male
one, in the center. One in the middle, hilarious. Standing there, smiling. Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. It's like, how do they not see it?
Yeah.
I don't think they don't see it. I don't think that's the issue. It's just they're catering to voters like any politician anywhere in the world. And if the vast majority of your voters are elderly men, then you cater to the elderly
this
men.
This one, this position was previously filled by a female, Abe-san. When Abe Sori was the prime minister here, he had a woman on that position. Whereas, unfortunately, after that, like now with Kishida, so the position went to somebody that was basically pitched by the party supporting this and that. And so he put the guy because they would not pitch a woman.
Well, the ministry in Japan, I think they, it's not about their skills, it's who they support. So
who they support, yes. It's not based on, it's not even shown whether he is fitted for the position.
No. It's like the...
Emil, can you give me permission to share just so that I can show that to somebody who's not familiar with the photo and the text?
Go ahead. So this is the photo of... Yeah, you can share now. This is the photo of the women... What's the proper name for it?
Ministry?
You see? Gender equality and women's empowerment.
Yeah.
Yes.
Was that the Minister of Equality or was
I think he was the... it was something like that. One second.
The chair. Yeah, he's the chair of the committee.
He's the chair.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Because women need to be told by a Japanese man how to be equal and have some you know.
I do like how he decided to wear his most colorful suit.
Yes.
We thank God for that at least, you know. At least he has a nice suit.
Yeah.
but it's just funny. It's funny. And that's how it works. You know, I mean, I could start writing a book on that in Japan because I think no, I don't have time.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to find time for my one.
But anyway, yeah.
Speaking of time, I'll have to butter off in a second. I'm sorry.
No problem. Me too. I have to actually.
Just before we go, can you just stop the recording just so I'll ask you a couple of questions, Emil?
Cool. Awesome. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for
your
time.
Thank you very much for joining us again.
Search Tokyo Dads on Facebook. Hopefully we have more stuff up and running by the time this podcast is out.
Oh, definitely.
Okay. Bye.
All right. That was a fun chat, wasn't it? I really enjoyed the last bit of it. Personally, a bit cringeworthy, but very entertaining. Hope you also found some value in the conversation. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa, and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company, and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com. And you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time. And until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.